here with us for the morning show as we talk about the ongoing work of Wisconsin's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force on this National Day of Awareness. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Attorney General Josh Call, he formed a task force last October. It's currently made up of 42 members. He told WBAY-TV at the time, there are gaps in the data, gaps in the reporting, what is known about these cases and why Indigenous women are targeted.
There isn't great data collection on this issue, and that's because it hasn't been examined through the lens specifically of missing and murdered women in Indigenous communities.
What do you want to tell this task force? What is not coming to light on this decades-long crisis? 800-642-1234. Justine Rufus is co-chair of the Task Force on Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. She's rural coordinator for Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault and an enrolled member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Justine, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for inviting me to the network.
Tell us, on this Day of Remembrance, what is being done?
So we have a large event planned for today. The task force started with a grassroots effort of women that came together from tribal communities to bring forward a bill to the state of Wisconsin. And we are always in tune with the family members and centering the Indigenous communities. So one of the things that they asked for is really to make this day not a national day, but recognize MMIW as a day of awareness in Wisconsin. And so we were really activated around 2 or 3 weeks ago to create this event and gather not only state representatives, but tribal representatives, and bringing them together to sign a proclamation recognizing this day as a day of awareness here in Wisconsin. So at 2:30 this afternoon, we're hosting the event. The task force will be hosting the event on Zoom, and we've opened this event up to the public to really come and join us as our tribal leaders and our governor and the attorney general and Lieutenant Barnes will all be in attendance. And we will all, the state of Wisconsin has officially signed their proclamation recognizing this day, along with our tribal leaders will be signing proclamations today. Mm.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the conversations you've had with families who have gone through this devastation? What have those conversations been like?
I think the families are frustrated. Mm. This issue, I know, is the term MMIW is gaining some awareness, but this issue has been very historical in our communities. It's happened for generations. And we often don't see justice in the way that I think that we would think of justice in outside of our community. So I think that as we speak with the families, they're excited about the fact that this is starting to gain some awareness. I think that's really important for the families, but also really listening to the families that there are so many roadblocks when it comes to helping our families. And from the onset of if someone goes missing to being able to have a search party, you know, it really starts with a real lack of resources. And so and then support when their family members go missing. And so I think that it's important to really listen to their voices as we go through this task force to find out what we can do for solutions.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Justine Rufus, who co-chairs the Task Force on Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. It's housed in the Department of Justice in partnership with Indigenous communities around the state. You can join in. What do you think of the work of this task force? What could be done? What would you like to see the task force focus on in working towards solutions? 800-642-1234. Justine, bring us up to speed on the work of the task force. What have you been doing?
Yeah, so we hosted our two meetings now, and so it took a while to get this. I know that the Attorney General announced mm-hmm. the task force quite a while ago, back in October. The pandemic did slow our process, and so it took a while for us to establish and convene for our first meeting. I think really the first couple of meetings, what we soon discovered is we do have a very large task force, but we did get a lot of folks, including family members, community members, that wanted to be involved in this work. And so we established four subcommittees mm. where folks can join us in this effort. And those subcommittees are becoming quite large. So we have four subcommittees, a data committee, a policy and legal committee, a family and community impact committee, along with a systems committee. And so each one of those committees are around 20 people and growing.
Wow.
And so we are coordinating these committees to really delve into the work and help us find solutions for these problems. So that's one of the big efforts. And then we have established a website. And so if you go in the Department of Justice, Wisconsin's Department of Justice, you can see that we have a web page that we've established for the public to really follow the work as we move through this process. We're also currently in the process of seeking out a research team to really help develop a plan, a report at the end of our task force work. And in addition to that, very uniquely, Wisconsin plans on establishing two reports. One is a report of kind of what are the root causes, what are some solutions, what are some mandates that we're going to ask for at the end of this task force.
Mm-hmm.
But the second thing that we've decided, which is really important, is the implementation plan. Mm-hmm. How are we going to move this work forward beyond the task force? And so I think that that's extremely important. So, and just recognizing that all of this, everything that the task force is doing is being led by our families and centering our families. And so even the way that we conduct our meetings, we've received feedback that it's very unique. It's indigenous led. It's being done with a real thoughtfulness about centering our families. And so that's really important, is as we move through this, to really center the voices of our families.
Yeah, really bringing a deeper meaning to the work. Let's go to Jesse now in Green Bay. Hi, Jesse. What would you like to say?
Good morning. I think this is an amazing topic, and I'm so glad that you guys are covering it. One thing that I know I get really confused on is I know that different tribes in Wisconsin have different agreements with the local authorities. I know some tribes have their police members are deputized in other areas. I'm wondering how that relationship with the local authorities plays into this issue of making sure that the missing women are given the same resources and the same importance.
Jesse, thank you. Justine.
I think that that's very important. So the relationship that they have. So, for example, if someone does go missing, we're really relying on our county partners or our local partners to enter that into the NCI database. And so from every step from an Amber Alert, we're really relying on the partnership that we have with the local authority to enact that Amber Alert. So really tribes lack the infrastructure, the databases to do that on their own. And so partnerships are very important. And so that's why we're so excited that this task force has such an interest. And we do have a lot of local partnerships, but it really can change if there isn't that really strong relationship with that local partner. On what can happen for the families when they're immediately missing.
I would imagine that having that clarity very early on when someone is missing is really important because, you know, who has jurisdiction? Who is taking the lead on the investigation? And just having that knowledge can make things go more quickly in those early hours when it's so vital.
Yes, and it's really having a contact person even for some of those, as simply as do you know who to call, and whether it's a child that goes missing, an adult that is missing, there's different systems that you have to work through. And so it's very important for these relationships to be established, not once things happen, but early.
We're talking with Justine Rufus, co-chairs the State Department of Justice's Task Force on Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. All of the state's 11 federally recognized tribal nations have a seat at the table. The task force meets again next month. What should be the centerpiece of their work in your mind? How will you mark today's day of remembrance? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll continue this in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the work of Wisconsin's task force to investigate missing and murdered Indigenous women. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is a task force led by the State Justice Department that is in partnership with tribal nations. Nationally, it's worth noting there's been some movement on this crisis. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland announced last month the creation of a unit to investigate missing and murdered Native Americans that will be housed within the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Do you live on a reservation? What connection do you have to this devastating issue? What will it take to shine a light on it and to get to solutions? Join in 800-642-1234. Justine Rufus is co-chair of the Task Force on Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. Justine, take us to the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa for a moment. You're a member. What is your tribal community seeing as far as violence against women and in this particular issue?
Bad River has a number of folks in it throughout our history that has gone missing. So this really, for our tribe, is very personal, this topic. And we say people, because I know we center this work around women, but the violence in our community against our people has been very high. Mm. And I know last year we really lost one of our, this would have been 2 years ago, but even our children. And so it's very important for us to center the voices of the families that are survivors and understand that this problem really does truly impact. As we were establishing this task force and getting it up since last October, I think that one of the questions when we brought this bill forward was, does this really happen in Wisconsin? And so it was really important for us to bring those voices to the front and say that, yes, this indeed is happening in our communities. And we lost two of our women in Wisconsin, you know, as this task force was getting established. And so it's very real. It is happening, and it really impacts our communities. And we have to find solutions. It really is depends on life or death in our community.
I want to look at policy legislative solutions. You have four lawmakers on the task force, two representatives, two state senators. What is their input from a policy standpoint?
Well, at this time, you know, that is really going to, the subcommittee, you know, that policy and legal committee is really going to work on finding out what are the gaps currently that are in the policies, what are policies that maybe we have that aren't being utilized that we currently have. So there really is a lot of work to do around policy in the state of Wisconsin. So we're just pleased to have so many experts in that can help us move those into the report and then the implementation plan. So that's something that they're discovering now. And so we're excited for them to convene. And their first meeting will be coming up, the subcommittee, on the 14th.
You know, you personally, how does your work on preventing sexual assault inform this work at all, this work on the task force?
Well, interestingly enough, most of the task force that have been developed really worked closely with the coalitions. And so I think it really has been wonderful that I am. I have already worked for the coalition, the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault, because this is one of our focus areas. And so it's really important for us to, I've I've been supported by the coalition. They're very helpful. And even small things as creating flyers and really supporting the task force in any way that they can. So it really does make sense for my organization to really support me in this work, and they are very supportive. So I can't say enough about the work that they're doing behind the scenes.
We're talking with Justine Rufus, who co-chairs the State Task Force on Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. The group was created last October by Attorney General Josh Call. It includes lawmakers, all of Wisconsin's tribal communities, along with Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes on the task force. You can join in 800-642-1234. Chris is with us from Racine. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm curious, since there's a task force for Indigenous women, that implies that there is a greater occurrence among Indigenous women, so what of missing or violence. What is the comparison to non-Indigenous, and is it a cultural issue of entitlement or a sense of, or a lack of self-worth or isolation that causes this? Is there something that we can do to educate the tribeswomen for greater assertiveness of themselves? Is it
Chris? Chris, let's let Justine jump in here.
Yeah, so we have a rate of missing folks much higher than any other population. And so I think that is, in fact, it's, you know, we talk about pandemic, epidemic, this, our rates of missing women in Indian country, and I say in the entire country, is in some cases it could be as much as 3 to 10 times higher. Mm-hmm. And I think that this was happening in other communities, there would really be a shock, you know, if it was happening in your neighborhood, we would probably really take notice of this type of violence that happening against our women. We don't know all the answers of why this is happening. We do know that there are some areas that can impact this, and part of that is the history of the treatment of Native women is really a part of that. We look at resources and man camps, and we're really trying to, as a country, trying to figure out why do we have so many women that are being violated this way in Indian country. And a big part of what we're discovering is that our laws within the boundaries of Indian country just don't, aren't as strict as what you would see in a county or a neighboring jurisdiction outside of Indian country. So it's very, jurisdictional issues, I think, are very important to look at as we're reviewing this in Wisconsin.
Justine, you mentioned the research team aspect of the work, building reports to look at root causes, a report on mandates. What is the timeline for these reports?
So we hope to get these established definitely within 18 to 24 months.
Okay.
Once that research team is hired.
And when you look at how the Department of Justice, the State Department of Justice, is going about this, do you find it productive? Do you have insights on how this work could be done more assertively and you know, make Wisconsin a leader on trying to find solutions?
Yeah, I think that's really important. I love that you asked that question, because I think it's really important that it is being run through the Department of Justice, but this is an issue that our entire state could really rally behind. And I know that currently we have, we're trying to gain that support. And so as we move forward and we build partnerships, we just want to keep adding to this task force, and it needs to last beyond this, you know, task force. It really is the action that comes from the work that we do that's really going to make the difference. Our whole response, the only reason that this task force is to save lives. And so we have to think beyond this task force. We have to think about the future, and we do have to become a leader in Wisconsin to really no longer tolerate this type of violence in Indian country.
very quickly as we wrap up, have you looked to other task forces in other states? Has that informed your work at all?
Absolutely. Actually, so exciting. In our very first meeting, we brought in Marion Buller from the Canadian Inquiry. They really, Canada was the leader in this type of research and discovery. And so if we look at the Canadian Inquiry, it really is a huge document that they worked on many years. In fact, they had two reports because the first was not Indigenous led. So we really brought in our partners from other states, Minnesota, New Mexico. We really met with them to find out what are their lessons learned, what would they have done differently.
And Justine, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Justine Rufus, co-chair of the Task Force on Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about a veteran who turned to religious service after his time in the military.
For Yao Yang, inclusion is a guiding principle. He moved to Wisconsin as a child and went on to join the Army National Guard, where he taught fellow U.S. soldiers about Hmong history. After his service, he became a pastor and founded a church in central Wisconsin. Yang shares his experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative. As a warning, some parts of the story describe battleground violence.
My name is Yao Yang. I am 39 years old, and I am talking to you from my house located in Merrill, Wisconsin. Growing up here in central Wisconsin was really challenging. I was born in a refugee camp in Thailand. I came to central Wisconsin when I was 7 years old. Life here in the United States was a little bit better than living in the refugee camps, but by American standards, we were still living in poverty. There was a wonderful lady. Her name was Anne Merrifield, and she was my English as a second language teacher. She understood that our family, we didn't have a whole lot. One winter, right before Christmas break, she had said, "Hey, Yao, why don't you and your family come over to my house for Christmas Day?" We just enjoyed all the festivities of what it meant to celebrate an American Christmas. And for the first time in my life, I finally felt like I belong here in the United States. I got this true American experience. She continued to take my family under her wing. The first time going camping was because of her. The first time catching a fish was because of her. She didn't have to do that as a teacher, but she went out of her way to truly give me this life experience. After I graduated from high school, a year later, September 11th happened. And that event really just profoundly changed me. You know, I just may be one person, but I want to make America safer. I knew that what I wanted to be was an American soldier, and so I needed to graduate boot camp in order to do that. When I was down there, I was the only Hmong soldier. People would come and ask me, "Hey, are you Chinese? Are you Japanese?" And I'm like, "No, I am Hmong." And so I would have to give all these people a history lesson about the Hmong people. December of 2004, I was stationed in Samarra, Iraq. And Samarra was so dangerous because the insurgents, they kept on planting IEDs, or the improvised explosive devices, on roadsides. So as American soldiers, we would sometimes walk by or drive by these areas that we don't even know where the bombs are, and they would detonate these bombs. The most scariest experience of my entire life is just feeling the shockwave of this ginormous IED just going off. And in my desperate measures, I pretty much said to God, "God, if you can get me out of Iraq alive, when I come back to Wausau, I'll do whatever you want me to do." It was for me to realize that I'm no longer in control of my life, and I have to turn things over to the Lord. In January of 2016, I started a church called The Cross in my own living room, because I didn't have a church building. And so we became multi-ethnic and non-denominational to really try to reach people of all color. I want to be able to tell my kids the reason why Daddy is who he is today is because of the blessings that I have received from all these other people. If there was one thing that I would just love for my kids to be able to learn from me, it is for them to just love all people, regardless of who they are and what they look like.
That was Yao Yang of Merrill, Wisconsin. He shared his experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
And now we look into the work of land surveyors. They pore over data from deeds and old maps, easements, roads. They prepare a survey plat that shows the actual location of a parcel of land and its boundaries. And they often have a role before property changes hands. A listener suggested we have a surveyor join us. Are you one, or did you get a survey done of your property? What was that like? What questions do you have about property boundaries? 800-642-1234 to join in. Ed Harvey is a licensed surveyor and engineer and president of the Wisconsin Society of Land Surveyors. Ed, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's take us right into the field and introduce us to your equipment. What is the device on a tripod that we see surveyors use to make their measurements?
Nowadays, there's a lot of devices, and some of them are mounted on tripods. Probably the principal one that you see people looking through and maybe mistake as a camera is a total station. It's a multifunctional instrument that automatically records angles and distances and maybe even computes coordinates to a data recorder so it can be directly downloaded into a computer. It's a pretty complicated high-tech piece of equipment compared to what we were using, you know, back in the 60s and 70s and 80s.
Yeah, I'd imagine technology has changed a lot. That sounds like very fancy equipment. You know, how have real-time GPS and robotic instruments changed this work?
It's huge. GPS, of course, is the biggest thing. It's not the catch-all, save-all thing that people think it is. It doesn't do well under trees, so we got kind of a lax period during the summer when the world it can function in becomes smaller. But in the wintertime, we can go to town with it. And it's extremely accurate, way more accurate than anything we had done up until the time that GPS came available and can be used for anything from boundary surveys to topographic surveys, you know, just about any application you can imagine.
So really versatile.
Yep.
Can you back up for us and describe the different types of land surveys and how they're used?
Well, there's, as far as land, you know, land surveyors work across a very broad area of practice, you know, from supporting engineers to mapping applications down to doing property surveys or boundary surveys, what you're calling a land survey. I guess I would lump those land surveys into a couple of different areas. One is we do plats of survey, and they're all filed with the county surveyor in each respective county once they're done. But those are just surveys of existing properties.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a property, you call a surveyor, say, I want to put up a fence. He'll come and do a plat of survey for you and determine where those property lines are, where the property, if there's any encroachments back or forth across the property lines, and you know, mark those points in the field. The other thing is if you're desiring to create a completely new property that never existed before, a surveyor will come out to your property and survey it and create a new lot or lots, and that might be a subdivision plat or it might be a certified survey map in Wisconsin, which is, and it's kind of a small subdivision plat. It's kind of unique to Wisconsin.
So what about the work of surveying involving highways and railroads? What is that work like?
Well, there's getting to be less and less railroad work around.
Okay.
Because there's getting to be fewer and fewer railroads around. But that's pretty fairly specialized. There aren't even a lot of surveyors that are familiar enough to work within railroads and on railroad infrastructure. Highways is probably the biggest area of practice for surveyors in Wisconsin. And we're hoping and expecting, I guess, even that this new infrastructure plan that we're seeing in the federal level is going to generate a lot of new work for surveyors. Our applications there are creating plats by which new highway rights of way can be acquired and purchased, but also supporting engineers by doing topographic surveys and construction staking of those new highways in the field. So a large part of our membership is specifically focused on highway work.
Is highway work more difficult in any way, or is it about the same as the other types of surveying?
I'm going to say that it's better defined. You know, what your end product is better defined, because basically you're working for one customer, mm-hmm. or at least one oversight agency, which is the Department of Transportation. I wouldn't say it's harder, but it's fairly specialized.
Fairly specialized. So, you know, can you describe when you are doing the research? I would imagine the research component is also very important. Looking at old land maps, for instance, what information do you need in order to prepare a land survey?
You need to do some level of research, and nowadays a lot of it can be done on the testing my theory here to the gills right now with COVID, but nowadays a lot of research can be done online.
Mm-hmm.
Even copies out of a Register of Deeds office can be acquired in most counties, or I should say a lot of counties, I guess, online, especially in the southeastern or southern part of the state. You need to do some research in order to determine the extent of your client's ownership, you know, what they actually own on paper. And you need to see what surveys have been done of that property in the past or of adjacent properties. You also need to know a little bit about the ownership of those adjacent property owners to see that there's no overlaps in title or gaps in title. But it can be fairly extensive. Highway research is a whole other thing, because the primary resting spot of those is in the local municipal offices. In some counties, that stuff has been collected and gathered and stored in another place. But it's a lot of those are easements also. They're not fee ownerships.
Hmm.
So they just override over the top of what you're surveying. They're not an entity unto itself.
So some of this would be to, some of this is online, but also some of this is actually going through, I would imagine, filing cabinets and other storage areas to get at these maps.
That's very true. I was a county surveyor for 31 years, and I was the keeper of those filing cabinets and storage areas.
We're discussing the work of land surveyors with Ed Harvey, president of the Wisconsin Society of Land Surveyors. Have you ever had a dispute with your neighbor over property boundaries? How did you reach a resolution about that tree, about that fence? What have you always wanted to ask a land surveyor about their work? Have you seen them taking measurements for a project in your community? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute with Ed Harvey right here on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're talking with Ed Harvey, president of the Wisconsin Society of Land Surveyors. This is a statewide organization formed almost 70 years ago, committed to the advancement of the surveying profession. And we're talking about this work thanks to a listener suggestion asking us to host a conversation about the work of land surveyors. Ed Harvey, he is with us for 10 more minutes. Mike is joining us from Cottage Grove. Hi, Mike. What would you like to say about surveying?
Well, yeah, we had a conflict with a neighbor over like essentially 2 feet. And I had the paperwork from the surveyor, and I showed him a couple times. And to make a long story short, he had a surveyor come in, and sure enough, I was right. But it got kind of touch and go for a little while because he took a weed whip to my face.
Oh, my goodness. So, So was this because you were looking at just property division, or was this because you wanted to add on, or why did it come up?
It was just existing, all existing, and it was just a mowing deal. And
a
one
mowing
day
deal. Okay.
Yeah. Make a long story short, but it got resolved, but it was kind of touch and go for a while.
Well, Ed Harvey, when do surveyors typically get called to look at residential properties?
There's a couple of things. First off, if somebody's building, they're going to be required to, often will be required to have a survey so that the agency, the town or the village or whoever's issuing the building permit knows that he's observing the setbacks that they require in their zoning ordinance or whatever correctly. The other thing is that if a property sale is sold, very often the lending institution will require a mortgage survey to make sure that there's no issues, encroachments back or forth across the property line, or property that's being held by an adjacent property owner, but which is rightly part of the property that's being described, in the sale. So those are the kinds of things that'll trigger surveys. Sometimes it's just two property owners not getting along or having a difference of opinion about where a property line is, and one of the people that can possibly help them with that is a surveyor if it's a physical encroachment. There is such a thing as a title issues also, in which case you may have to deal with another professional to iron that sort of an issue out.
Has it ever come up where two property owners are in a dispute over boundaries? They each hire a surveyor, but those surveyors reach different results. How do you resolve the conflict at that point?
Usually, if there's the best thing is if two surveyors are talking from the beginning.
Okay.
So that one doesn't know something the other doesn't know. So that they are able to come to some sort of an agreement or understanding about where the other is and either dispute it in a professional way, come to a agreement that between the two of them, this is where things all ought to be and this is how it ought to be done.
We heard from Brian in Appleton, called in and wants to know, what would be an average cost to have Brian's house surveyed?
It depends an awful lot. There's a big range, and people often say, well, my buddy had his done and it was only this. But really, the number one issue is if surveyor has done a survey of that property in the past or has done nearby surveys, that he's at least familiar with what's there in the subdivision or in the section that he's going to be working in. If a guy is coming in cold and fresh, it's probably going to cost a little more. And if he knows that there's issues in that subdivision, that there's problems, it's probably going to be a little more.
How do property boundaries work near water, where the land may change, you know, due to flooding or droughts or things like that?
Yeah, water boundaries are always fun. I had one surveyor friend who said never agree to do a job in a village that has a water street. So that's a little extreme, I guess. But water boundaries are a whole different set of problems, because as the water rises and falls, in a lot of, now with streams, you actually own to the center of the stream. And the, what I'm saying now is some general things, not rules to live by. So you own to the center of the stream, subject to an easement for the flooded area. So as the water goes up and down the public highway, which is the stream, and it comes further into your property. On lakes, the state of Wisconsin holds the lake bed in trust, and as the water goes up and down again, it moves. Now, if it goes up and down overnight, you know, there's a radical change by some event caused by God, the property line may move. If it, it may not move, so you'll continue to own to whatever the old property line was. But if the line slowly changes, you know, by accretion or erosion, you may wind up losing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a matter of being able to document how it changed, when it changed, and it can be... There's some really interesting things that have gone on in Wisconsin having to do with water boundaries.
We're talking with Ed Harvey, president of the Wisconsin Society of Land Surveyors. Jody is joining us from Monona. Hi, Jody.
Hi. My question is, when you have trees that are overhanging into your property, can you cut them off? I have a neighbor's tree that's about 15 feet in my property, and it's dripping sap all over my vehicle. So I'll take it off the air.
Jody, thanks. Ed?
Yeah, that's really a question for a lawyer more than a surveyor. A surveyor can tell you where the line runs through the trees, but I don't know that I would want to give somebody permission to start cutting on the neighbor's trees. I think a lawyer would tell you, though, that the overhanging part is fair game.
I would imagine attention to detail is really critical in your job. How do you feel about your ability to pay attention to the minute details?
Yeah, you can never be too observant. You know, sometimes the smallest thing is the key to understanding what's gone on there in the past and unraveling the history.
Yeah, so doing a bit of that detective work as well. What do you love about the work?
Well, that's it. It's you know, you're an archaeologist. You get to go out there and dig around in the dirt looking for traces of left behind by past surveyors. You're a historian. You get to go through all these old minutes of surveys and documents and stuff. You're a technician. You're into the most recent, you know, technology that's out there anywhere. It's no 2 days are the same.
Ed, thank you for joining us.
You bet. Thanks a lot for having us.
Ed Harvey is president of the Wisconsin Society of Land Surveyors. Just ahead, there's a new effort to change what schools teach about Native American history and how they go about it. We have the State Department of Public Instruction's consultant on American Indian Studies. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.